From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1943 when an Austrian-American physician named Leo Kanner published a landmark paper called Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact. He described 11 children who were highly intelligent while also showing a, quote, powerful desire for aloneness and an obsessive insistence on persistent sameness. Kanner would name their condition early infantile autism. But as with so much of history, this potential breakthrough was not a smooth one. In the years that followed, there was a rising tide of blaming the parents. Doctors talked about mothers who didn't show enough warmth and love for their kids, thus creating children who struggled with emotions. ABC News correspondent John Donvan is the co-author of a new book called In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. In just the past few months, it has been reviewed in The New Yorker at length and many other places, and Donvan tells the story of how our understanding of autism has evolved, often painfully. For all the credit Kanner received for his landmark paper, he also gets the credit for coining the term refrigerator mothers. It took decades to get past this concept of blaming the parents. And the book brings us to the present, in which autism is not only better understood, but recognized as a component of diversity. A long list of some of the most successful artists, writers, even elected leaders are thought to have been on the spectrum. John Donvan is coming to Rochester this weekend as a guest of Autism Up. The organization recently moved into a large new headquarters. They're hosting their annual gala on Saturday at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Let me go ahead and welcome my guests for the hour. On the phone with us is John Donvan, co-author of In a Different Key. John, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Evan, I'm great, and it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, it's great to have you. Also with us is Sarah Milko, the executive director of Autism Up. Sarah, welcome to you.
Hi,
as well.
Welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Lawrence Sugarman's here, research professor and director of the Center for Applied Psychophysiology and Self-Regulation at RIT. He'll correct me if I missed any of that, Dr. Sugarman.
It's great to be here. You did a great job.
Thank you. Nice to see you back here as well. Eric Sheely is here, executive director of the ARC Foundation, and they have an event as well. A lot going on with John Donvan. Eric, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks, Evan. It's great
well
to be here.
So, John, you're going to be in Rochester a couple times coming up, and before we get to your visits and your book, just a brief interruption from my colleague, Veronica Volk, as we are getting near the end of our spring membership campaign.
Yes, we are, and like you said, brief, because I really don't want to distract from these valuable conversations, but they are valuable. I mean, just a really quick personal story. I was at dinner talking to some of my friends about a topic that you had talked about on your show, and maybe your listeners can relate to this, but a waiter actually came up and chimed in. He's also a listener, also a fan, and it's really it really just shows the value of the show and the community. We were talking about how talented you are as a moderator, and you're able to bring these topics to us in a way that you know, gives them space, gives them a chance to breathe, and gives us a chance to really have a good discourse about them. So if you're listening and you can relate to what I'm talking about, you can give us a call at 1-800-295-9994. That's if you're listening live, or maybe you're listening on a podcast later. You can go to wxxi.org/give, and you can donate there. It just takes a couple minutes, a couple dollars, to show us that you appreciate this programming.
Well, thank you, Veronica. wxxi.org/give. And we need you this week. We are a long way from our goal, I will be honest with you. We got a long way to go in the next 24 hours or so, and I hope you help us close that gap. John Donvan's on the line with us, the author of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. And John, I don't have to tell you that there are a number of books in recent years on autism. And before we talk about and work our way through your book, tell us why you wanted to write this, why you thought that there was a need for this book and these stories now.
Well, two things. The first thing I have to say is that I didn't write it alone. I have a co-author, Karen Zucker, who is a producer at ABC News of many years standing. She's now also doing work for PBS, and she is the mother of a son who was diagnosed with autism back in 1997. He actually turned 22 2 days ago, so she has long experience in this. And she and I did a lot of the early reporting on autism that was even seen on network television, going back to the early 2000s when there really was almost no discussion of autism, believe it or not, only 15 years ago in the mainstream media. And we began, after her son was diagnosed, reporting on autism because she felt that there were stories that needed to be told, and not the kinds of stories that had been seen before. The few times that autism was mentioned, which was usually about some great autistic skill that an individual might have or some story about a miracle cure, but the real lives of people with autism, the challenges they faced, the challenges that their families faced, the challenges that girls with autism faced, which were distinct and unique and a little discussed, the challenges of being bullied in school for children who are on the spectrum. And then we came to this point where we said, let's try to do something more enduring. And we concluded that autism had a really amazing, illustrative, disturbing, inspiring backstory to it, a history to it, that nobody really knew. And I say nobody really knew. We didn't know about it until we started looking into it and found out how far we had come in not only understanding what we meant by autism, which has been a very, very slippery concept, but more importantly, how very far we had come in making a place in the world for kids with autism. We've come so far because, just going back 30, 35 years ago, kids with autism were not allowed in school, and they were more or less almost always institutionalized, usually for life. And we've come so far in that, but we also recognize that when it comes to adults with autism, we still have a lot to do, a long way to go. So we thought, let's look at the past, look at the battles that were fought, real civil rights battles, and use those stories to try to inspire people to do better by adults with autism in the future.
John, I think what surprised me most, among many things, but what surprised me most is the history of parent blaming. And, I can hardly think of something more sad than having to try to understand what your child is going through, how to help them, and then feeling the medical community blaming you.
Yeah, and we forget that, too. We forget a lot of the story, but that was so powerful an impulse on the part of the psychiatric establishment at the time to blame the parents, especially the mothers, that I'll tell you this, if this were 1965 or 1970 even, and we went to the library, you or I or a parent of a newly diagnosed child went to the library to learn more about autism, all of the books there would have said autism is the mother's fault. The mother failed to love the child during the child's first days of life. The child sensed this, and as a defense mechanism, retreated into this world behind this so-called wall of autistic traits and was hiding from the reality of his mother's lack of love. Or even, one doctor said on television, the mother's wish that the child were dead. And it's as incredible as that sounds now, that was 100% the authority's opinion on what autism was about, until really, I would say, well into the 1970s. And this had a number of consequences. As you mentioned, number one, what a burden on the parents, especially on the mothers, who were already overwhelmed with trying to care for a child who would be severely autistic. And in those days, the label was given to children who had the more severe behaviors. Number two, to be told that it was your fault, and to have this reflected through the media, through culture. When, you know, we talked with mothers, Karen and I talked with mothers, especially Karen sat down with some of these women and talked with them for hours, who talked about going into medical facilities and saying, I'm here to see Dr. such and such about my child with autism, and getting dirty looks from the staff because they saw this mother almost as a child abuser. That they had to live through that kind of thing was just awful. And number three, really important, because psychiatry had the answer, knew what autism was caused by, and it was mothers. That meant that for 30, 40 years after the diagnosis was first brought into view, starting in the 1940s, really no other kind of research was done, because the answer was there. Mothers caused autism. Why look for any other answers? So it really, really had a negative impact.
For listeners who, like me, if this a lot of this history is new to you and it's stunning to you that the medical establishment would blame the mothers, you know, that term, refrigerator mothers, amazing term. What a cold, awful term. And 1959, Scientific American had an article, Joey, a Mechanical Boy, you know, with this idea that autism is the response of kids who are dealing with that lack of warmth in parenting. These were not fringy, as you say, John, these are not sort of fringy, far out there, sort of quackery ideas. Mainstream, right?
Absolutely mainstream. And here's the thing, is that the parents who were being told this were very, very isolated in that period. There was no internet, obviously, we know that. They had no way to know whether there were other parents like them. Most people, most families who had a child diagnosed had a sense of intense isolation, increased by the fact that society did not want to see their kids. Doctors and even family friends and priests and lawyers told families, put the child away in an institution, pretend the child doesn't exist. we heard that story again and again and again, because there was so much shame associated with having a child with an obvious developmental disability. And lots of families did that, not because they didn't love their child, it was the opposite, but because they were under so much pressure to do so. And the fact that in the end, parents found a way to communicate with each other, to connect with each other, to build an organization. And the first autism organization was founded in the United States in 1965 in Teaneck, New Jersey, by a group of parents who had discovered each other more or less by accident and had been driving around, placing ads in newspapers and magazines, you know, trying to call meetings in various towns and various states saying, if your child is diagnosed with autism, come to a meeting, we're trying to build an organization. That was really built from the ground up, and the inaugural meeting took place in 1965 in Teaneck, starting a national organization. And that group was the group that really began to finally push back against the refrigerator mother theory, and finally succeeded in defeating it, and found allies in the scientific community and in the educational community, particularly, interestingly enough, in North Carolina. A psychologist there named Eric Schopler kind of turned the whole idea on his head and said, instead of parents being the cause of autism, they were part of the solution and part of the treatment of autism. And very gradually a pushback began to happen then, so successfully that now the idea seems crazy and also forgotten and very distant. But it was very, very, very real. You know, in 1969, Elvis Presley made his last movie, and in that movie he played a psychiatrist, and a child was brought to him, and the child wasn't speaking. He looked at the child for 30 seconds, and he said, "This child has autism. What the child needs is love." And so he hugged the girl. Her name was Amanda. He hugged her, and he said to her, "I love you, Amanda. I love you, Amanda. I love you, Amanda," in his Elvis voice. And he said it a few times, and then after about a minute, Amanda, responding to his love, began to speak, and she was cured of autism. And there completely was the message from Hollywood that if there was autism, it was because the mother, who in this story had abandoned the child, had failed to love the child, and all the child needed was sufficient love, and autism would be all gone.
That's 1969, wasn't even controversial then. And so throughout history, talking to John Donvan about his new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, throughout history, we have these historical markers that help push sort of the public consciousness forward. Certainly Rain Man, 1988, Dustin Hoffman's performance, Oliver Sacks's book, 1995, Temple Grandin's story. I read Mark Haddon's novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which is about a dozen years old now, which I thought was, you know, to me was fascinating. And these are some of the ones that are more well-known. But as the New Yorker's profile of John Donvan's book notes, and I would just say, I think that was in the January issue, but easy to find. And listeners, check it out. A very interesting review, and I think a helpful review of the book. One of the book's heroes is Ruth Sullivan. Tell us a little bit about that, John.
Ruth Sullivan was, Ruth Sullivan is a mother of a boy named Joe Sullivan. Ruth is now about 90 years old. Back in 1964, 1965, she was one of those mothers who was told, number one, you caused your child's autism. Number two, you need to put your child in an institution for life. Well, here's the thing about Ruth. She had seven children, and she looked around her kitchen table where there were nine chairs, seven kids and her husband, and she said, only one of my kids has autism and the rest don't. So right here I have an experiment that proves that I'm not causing autism, because I would have seven children with autism, not one, if I were causing autism. And she was one of those mothers who started pushing back that organization. She lived around Albany. She'd come up from Louisiana, her husband was a college professor, and he got a college job teaching near Albany. And that kind of made upstate New York a real locus of autism activism in the 1960s. There was a time period, as we write in the book, when people around Albany and the states, all the way actually up to Rochester, that part of New York State had more autism coverage going on in the local press than most of the rest of the country combined would have for another 10 years. And that's because Ruth Sullivan was a very, very canny organizer. And she gathered a group of women together around Albany. There was a very small number of them who had children diagnosed with autism. And they were all brought to a meeting by a psychiatrist who wanted to create a sort of support session for them, have all of the mothers get together. Well, Ruth Sullivan was a doer. She was a former Army nurse. She was a member of the activist in the League of Women Voters. She said, I don't want to have some sob session with other mothers. And by the way, this psychiatrist who brought them together was a classic mother blamer. She was bringing these mothers together so that they could lean on each other and share their guilt over having caused autism and try to get over their guilt. She just didn't buy it at all. So she went to the first meeting with these mothers, and she sort of secretly passed a piece of paper around and asked everybody, write down your name and address. Everybody did, about 11 women. The next day she went home and she started calling them, and she said, let's start our own organization. So she started her own organization. That's the one that ultimately grew into the national organization. And she began reaching out to the news media a lot. So we discovered with the, you know, luckily for us, you know, the newspapers from that period are now almost all digitized. And so we found a lot of coverage in the Albany Press, Syracuse Press, Rochester newspapers about autism. Interestingly enough, often featuring Ruth's son, Joe. And there was a story about how Joe had a very, very strong streak of intelligence, but he was also very autistic. He used language in unusual ways, socially disconnected. And Ruth was convinced that he could go to school, and she pushed very, very hard to get him into a classroom with an aide. Back in the 1970s, when this was very unusual, and she got a newspaper story written about him, and about 2 months later, she got the aide. And so that upstate New York part is, interestingly, because of Ruth Sullivan living in Albany, being halfway up, really is a very, very, very strong streak in our book. And Ruth, as I said, is still alive today, and we've interviewed her, and she's like a lot of these parents who made these changes. The parents of children with autism today are really standing on their shoulders of that generation, but that generation's being forgotten. And to us, Karen and me, they are unsung heroes, and that's really the reason, among many others, that we wanted to tell their stories.
My guest is John Donvan, ABC News correspondent and co-author of the new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. And I would like our guests in studio to not only weigh in on some of what they've been hearing, but to remind our audience how they can meet John and what they've got coming up. Sarah Mocco is the executive director of Autism Up. And first of all, on Saturday, you've got a big day coming up, Sarah. What's coming up?
We have our annual gala event. It's at the Convention Center, Saturday, May 7th, starting at 6:30. It's our biggest fundraising event of the year.
Still time to get involved and go?
Absolutely. Check out our website if you're interested in coming, autismup.org. Lots of room, but we are banking on about 450 people to come and help us raise funds so we can continue to provide supports and social and recreational opportunities for our families living locally with autism.
John will be there to not only to talk, but also to sign books, I suspect. Yes, Sarah?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Karen as well.
And Karen.
I keep leaving Karen Zucker out, which is not fair. John and Karen are the co-authors. And John, briefly, by the way, just remind us again the personal connections that you and Karen have to autism and why you decided to write the book together.
Karen has a son. She wanted the world to understand what he needs, who he is, what people like him are like, to be accepting of them, to want to have their back. I happen to have a connection through my wife. My wife grew up in Israel, and her brother, who's now approaching 50 years old, has autism of a very severe kind. He can't speak. He's not able to function independently. But he's had a very, very good life thanks to his mother, who turns out to be kind of a Ruth Sullivan figure in Israel. My mother-in-law started Israel's first autism organization, built its first schools, built its first residences for adults. So, in fact, that was how I found out that there was this really interesting past, because she said to me, families today have a lot of challenges, but it used to be a lot, lot worse.
Talking to John Donvan, the co-author with Karen Zucker, of the new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. Sarah, you wanted to weigh in as well?
I was just going to say, John, the piece of your book that I so enjoyed was learning of that history. As a parent myself of a child with autism, and you talk about Ruth Sullivan, you know, our local organization, Autism Up, really started the same exact way. We were parents that started 11, 12 years ago, just a small group of us who had kids with autism, and we were looking for support and additional opportunities for our kids. So it's really nice to hear about those other pioneers before us and know that we're carrying on that message to get more for our children.
Parents really have been the standard bearer of change, and that's changed somewhat in the last 15 years as people with autism who are self-advocates, who can speak for themselves, have also become campaigners for exchange and acceptance. But that's a new development. For the first 50 years or so, it is parents like you who really changed the world. And it was the obstacles you faced have been enormous. And part of our reason in writing the book, and we've been very, very fortunate, it's been very successful very quickly. It became a bestseller in the New York Times very quickly. But we know that's mostly because it's being read by people who have a connection to autism. What we really want to say is that this is a book for people who have no connection to autism to know that they have a very, very important role to play in the lives of people who do have autism. The way the rest of us respond to people with autism is so determinative of the kinds of experience and opportunities they have in life and the acceptance they have. There's a story we tell near the end of the book about a scene that took place a few years ago, 10 years ago, in New Jersey on a bus in a town called Caldwell. And the bus was a regular city bus, and there was a young man with autism sitting by himself on the front seat. And this was a guy named Nicholas. He was a late teens. He looked like an adult man, and he did not speak. And he began to make some odd noises as the bus moved across the city, and he began, you know, squealing and rocking back and forth in his seat and flipping his fingers in front of his face. These are all, in some autistic people, classic traits of classic behaviors of autism. And two guys sit down behind him, and his movements, Nicholas's movements and voice sounds, begin to upset these guys, and they lean into him and they start to harass him. And they say, "Hey man, you know, what's your problem? Anyway, why don't you cut it out?" And at that moment, another passenger in the bus stood up in support of Nicholas and said to these two guys, "What's his problem? He's got autism. What's your problem? Why don't you just back off?" And at that moment, the witness who was there who told us the story said he could really feel that everybody else in the bus was inspired by that guy who stood up and defended Nicholas. And they were all figuratively on Nicholas's side in that moment. And it silenced those two bullies. And what we want to say with our book is, to people who are not connected to autism, you are passengers on that bus. You have the choice to be the bully or to be the guy who stands up on support of people like Nicholas. And that makes all the difference in the life of a person like Nicholas, his ability to ride on the bus. And the reason he was on the bus, he was getting lessons in how to ride the bus. He had a teacher way in the back who had been teaching him for days and days how to get around on a bus, which was a very challenging thing for him. If those bullies had won, Nicholas would have failed. He would never have gotten on a bus again. But now he's a guy who can travel. That's a big, big deal. And that's because somebody stood up, and we can all stand up. So that's who our book is for, not just for the autism community, but for everybody else, to understand that we have a role in how we treat people who are different.
All right, so you can meet John, get the book on Saturday at the annual gala, and you can still get tickets where?
www.autismup.org.
And then Tuesday, June 14th, another event, John and Karen coming back here. And Eric Sheely, what's coming up then?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a great opportunity for people to really come out. There's no charge. On the 14th, which is Flag Day, I know, but...
June 14th, by the way.
June 14th.
June 14th.
Yep. Karen and John are going to be coming, and they'll be doing a book signing with the community at the Pittsford Barnes & Noble. And then free of charge at the JCC from 7 to 8:30, they're going to be doing a community presentation and a Q&A afterwards. And it's so exciting for us because the Arca Monroe is 60 years old. And we hear these stories, and especially hearing them straight from John just in the last few minutes. You know, I've had the pleasure to meet with some of our founding members who are 93, 95, 96 years old. They went through the exact same things here in Rochester. And they had to come together. They took boxes door to door to raise funds and then go to Albany and fight for some initial services. And it's just amazing when you see the generation year after year advancing. And our founders would say the biggest component is you have to be an advocate for your children. You have to be an advocate for your family and really fight. And despite today having so much access, you still have to fight.
So that is June 14th at 7 o'clock at JCC's Heart Theater.
Yep.
And you can get involved by going where?
They can go to the arcamonroe.org website today and see that. And then on Monday, it'll be on the autismup.org website as well.
All right, very good. And I've got a little bit more I want to work through with the book, and then we'll take your phone calls as well for John and the panel. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I want to ask Dr. Sugarman just to weigh in on, first of all, the history. I mean, here we are in 2016. I know you're working in various ways to help families, to help with different ideas for therapies, et cetera. I know how personal and how emotional it can be for families. Is it hard for you to understand a world in which it was a blame the mother's mentality?
Right, right. And I got to thank you, John and Karen, for this contribution. The part of the problem is that I got through this book in the last 3 days, and which meant I read it a lot at night. And it's a courageous book, but there's some real disturbing parts of this book. And then you go to sleep and you have really disturbing dreams because of the intensity of these stories. And I think one of the things I value about the book is that you guys made these stories. Made these stories so that the people who need to stand up on the bus can get it. The people who already got the stories are just finding affirmation. But the people who don't know about these stories can live them through the book. So I'm grateful for that. And it's a courageous book because it's about these people who have this courage. I noted while you were talking, I just wrote down feminism, because what does it take for a mother especially in the 40s, 50s, 60s, to stand up to the male psychiatric medical establishment and say, no, you're full of it. It's not true. I know me. I know who I am. That's pretty incredible. There are some courageous fathers in the story, but there are a lot of courageous mothers. So I think, and the only other thing I want to say about history is that this is like a lot of other stories of change. This is really a reflection of a societal history, eugenics 100 years ago to where we are now, and a reflection of the change in health and care history. I think with the move away from diagnostic labeling, and the part of the story is the controversy of diagnostic labeling, because as we often say, the most salient feature of autism is it's heterogeneic. Nobody's the same. So away from just diagnoses to looking at abilities, looking at resources, looking at risk factors, and balancing those, I think that's the next step. We're going to move away from calling people names and starting to say, so what do you got? And what can you do? And how do we as a society, how do we as physicians and care providers build on those abilities?
Sure. And John Donvan, you know, the one of the big modern debates is, should we be trying to cure autism?
Yeah, and it's a very, very fraught debate. That 45 years ago we would not be having, because in that period, people who had the label autism were people like my brother-in-law, who were so severely impaired that their parents wanted nothing more than for those traits that limited their abilities and independence and freedom in life to go away. But since then, the concept of what we call autism has expanded, and very deliberately so. This really started in England with a researcher named Lorna Wing, a psychiatrist who was pretty brilliant, who had a daughter with autism. And she did a lot of writing and a lot of, she also faced the refrigerator mother theory in the early days and fought back against it. But she began to notice that some people had autistic traits in milder and milder degrees. Same sorts of traits. What I mean is some difficulty with social interaction, perhaps, or an obsessive interest to the degree that it sort of interfered with life to be so focused on just one topic. Maybe it could be children who are obsessed with train timetables or calendars and only wanted to talk about that. But she also saw that those traits existed in people who had fully developed language and sometimes brilliant intelligence. And she said we should count those people as having let's give those people the label autistic as well and include them together and lump them together with the people who are more severely affected. And that's where the idea of the autism spectrum was born. It's very influential idea today. Karen and I in the book take the position that the autism spectrum is very influential and popular. It's not necessarily going to withstand the test of time, because there's also thinking that autism, which is not something that you can diagnose by a DNA test or any sort of biological test or a cheek swab, it's not diagnosed that way. It's diagnosed by watching how somebody behaves and then matching their behaviors to a checklist of symptoms. And the checklist has changed many, many times. And as a result of that, the whole concept of what is autism is really actually very squishy and very much debated. And so where this comes down to the question of cure, there are parents, as I was saying, who would like nothing more than their children to have their children cured. But there are people who are on the autism spectrum themselves today, as it's now defined, who are perfectly happy with how they are and who they are. They acknowledge that maybe society isn't so nice to them. They pick on them. They exclude them. They mock them. They don't include them as friends. They isolate them. They don't hire them for jobs. And all of those things they would like to change. They would like society to change. But they don't want to change themselves. And so they're very offended by the word cure autism, because they're saying, if you want to cure autism, you want to destroy who I am. And that's a very big fault line now in the autism conversation between those who say it's fine to be autistic, it's a way of being human, it should not be suppressed or cured or treated into non-existence, against families who say, my child has no shot at independence in life because of autism, I would like that to change, I would like that to go away. And that's a very, very tense conversation going on nowadays.
All right, admission from the host. I'm feeling a little bit of a sense of panic that the hour is going to get away from me before I can get through half of what I want to. So let's get our only break of the hour. And what I'm going to do is this. If you're on the phone waiting to join the conversation, we're coming to you very soon. We're going to continue the conversation with John Donvan about his new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. Whatever we don't get through, you can pick up the book on Saturday. And we're going to talk to Sarah Milko from Autism Up. They've got a new home, a lot going on with them as well. So let's get this only short break of the hour and come right back to the conversation next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Nazareth College is getting ready to host what they think is probably the first conference regarding faith and climate change, how those two things intertwine. We'll preview it. Then in our second hour, Steve Miller, the Hall of Fame rocker, recently bashed the Hall of Fame and the music industry. And now modern struggling musicians are firing back. Talk with you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The history of addressing autism has included a number of frauds. And, barely have any time to even tap into things like FC, facilitated communication, Ouija boards, things that I had no idea about that will really open your mind to what has happened along the way before we've gotten to this point in understanding autism and how we approach it. But let me read a listener email that I got just before the show began today. And let's see here. Here it is. And so this comes from a listener named Rebecca. She says, Evan, my son has autism. I will get your guest book. I am wondering why you haven't talked about Robert De Niro's new film about autism. Everyone seems to want to center it. Can your guests explain why? Now, Robert De Niro recently revealed that his 18-year-old son has autism. De Niro claims his son changed overnight after getting the MMR vaccine. And the film, I don't know if he produced it or I don't exactly know his connection, but the film's called Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe. And De Niro claims he's not anti-vaccine, but he just wants to find out the truth. So John Donvan, I'm sure you're aware of that discussion. Can you respond to Rebecca's question?
Yeah, back in 1998, a physician, a gastroenterologist in London named Andrew Wakefield, published a study in which he suggested that children who were getting the MMR vaccine, and that's the vaccine that in one dose has the three vaccines mixed together for measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR, were also exhibiting signs of autistic behaviors soon after getting the vaccination, and that these children did not exhibit those signs before. And this started off, I would say, a decade-long argument and controversy over whether vaccines were causing autism. It became a very, very acrimonious, painful argument between families who were absolutely certain that they had seen this happen to their kids and scientists who were saying they thought it was really, really unlikely that vaccines were doing this. There was an enormous breakdown in trust between science and families. There was a very, very big loss of confidence in vaccines to the point where in the United Kingdom, where this was a big story, and the U.S., where this became a big story, families began to stop vaccinating their kids. And in some places, this resulted in the fresh outbreaks of diseases like measles that were considered to have been conquered. Simultaneously in the U.S., a second question was raised about vaccines, about whether some vaccines contained a small amount of mercury as a preservative, whether that mercury was a harmful incident causing autism in their kids. And what you had was families the testimony of families saying, my kid was fine, got the vaccine, and then my kid had autism, against scientists saying that doesn't make any sense. And we take the position in the book that it was reasonable to ask the question back then. And the reason is that there suddenly seemed to be a lot more autism being diagnosed in the United States. Now, there are a lot of reasons that it looked like there was more autism being diagnosed in the United States that may not relate to there actually being more autism. There's the fact that, as I mentioned before, the autism spectrum came into focus. That included many more people than before. And there were other reasons for thinking that we were counting better the autism that used to be there than before. This was not very convincing to the families, who began to say there must be some sort of conspiracy among the scientists and the government and journalists who are reporting that vaccines don't cause autism, that they must be all in the pay of the pharmaceutical industry. And really, claims became into focus of a great big plot, further eroding trust between established science and the families. However, what finally happened was studies were undertaken early in the 2000s. Study after study at the epidemiological level, where they looked at large populations in many countries and said, is there an increase in autism that matches up with the increase in the amounts of vaccines kids are getting? And the answer was no. The answer was no again and again and again and again. And we take the position in the book that the question was worth asking when it first came up, but it was asked and it was answered. And what happened with Robert De Niro is that Andrew Wakefield, who was the scientist who first came up with that claim in 1998 in London in his study, was exposed as having fiddled his results and having had a conflict of interest in which he was actually working for lawyers who represented families who were trying to sue the pharmaceutical industry. And so discredited was Wakefield's work that he lost his medical license. His major article was retracted by the journal that had published it. And Wakefield is considered discredited, but he doesn't give up. And he made a film that was entered in the Tribeca Film Festival. And the De Niro connection is that De Niro runs the Tribeca Film Festival. And he okayed the film, but then he, under a lot of pressure, he canceled. This all happened last month. He canceled the film, and then he regretted canceling it. And he went on the Today Show and said, you know what, I think the question needs to be asked, do vaccines cause autism? And my problem with that, I'm a big De Niro fan, my problem with that is the question was asked. It's the question that's been most asked probably in the last 15 years than any other question in autism. It's the question that has undergone more focused research than any other research question in autism in the last 15 years. And it was asked, and it was answered, that vaccines don't cause autism.
All right, thank you for clearing that up. I appreciate that. All right, let's go ahead and start working through some of your phone calls. Bill and Victor, first up. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, so back to Lee O'Connor. My father was on the faculty of child psychiatry and pediatrics at Johns Hopkins Hospital.
Wow.
In the 40s through the early 80s, and Lee O'Connor was his mentor. There wasn't a party at my parents' house that Lee O'Connor wasn't present at when I was growing up in the 50s. I'd like to say, I think Lee O'Connor, in a way, is like Freud. So most of Freud's theories have been largely discredited, and yet what he did was open up a questioning of certain things that hadn't really been questioned before. Lee O'Connor created a diagnosis for a constellation of symptoms that hadn't been considered before. The pieces hadn't been put together before. And so as misguided as some of his causation ideas might have been, he at least deserves the credit for seeing a constellation of symptoms that hadn't been put together before. And the other thing about Lee O'Connor was that my father had no advanced degrees. He had a theory about stuttering being caused, at least in many cases, by psychological factors, which was something at the time it was all considered to be physical, to be a constitutional issue, a mechanical problem. And one thing led to another. He went to see Lee O'Connor at the suggestion of a teacher he had at a community college in Baltimore, and Lee O'Connor saw the possibility of that idea and invited my father to join the faculty, even though he didn't even have a bachelor's degree. So Lee O'Connor was kind of a complex man. And for all of the damage that he did, it wasn't entirely black and white.
Thank you, Bill. Go ahead, John Donvan.
Absolutely agree. I want to make this clear. Karen and I have a huge respect for Leo Kanner. Leo Kanner was the first person to propose the idea that maybe the parents' behaviors, which he observed that some of the parents seemed cold and distant towards their kids in the first few hundred children he diagnosed, that a significant number of them seemed that way. Kanner from the beginning thought autism was probably something kids were born with, but he raised the question, since I'm seeing observing these behaviors in the parents, maybe, he suggested, that also has a role in it. And for a few years, he focused more on that than on the idea that autism was something that the kids were born with. But it was actually only for a few years. And he backed away from it rather early. At least by the mid-1950s, he backed away from it. And then he became a very strong opponent of the idea that mothers caused autism. And it was another guy named Bruno Bettelheim he's the one I talked about before, who went on television and wrote the books blaming mothers. And Kanner began to become a very fierce critic of Bettelheim's blaming mothers. So the more nuanced version of the story is that Kanner, in his sort of honest intellectual, searching around for understanding of this thing that nobody really understood, first said, I think kids are born with it, but I also think maybe parents have something to do with it. He even, by 1950, said maybe some of these parents have autism themselves, and that's why I'm seeing them being somewhat distant. So to us, Leo Kanner is no villain at all. He was a guy who, as the caller just said, made enormous contributions, was enormously respected by his colleagues, and also by the families in the autism world. Ruth Sullivan of Albany, New York, is on record as referring to Kanner as our beloved Dr. Kanner, speaking to the rest of the autism community in 1969. So we want to be clear, Kanner first threw the idea out there, but he wasn't an evangelist for the idea. That was up to other people.
All right, Terry in Brighton has a question for Dr. Sugarman. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes, Dr. Sugarman. I'm a mother of a 28-year-old who you were the doctor for, and we went to Dr. Rita Underberg to get a diagnosis at 2. We went to Mark McBride when he was about 7 or 8. And literally, everybody was sort of not really putting all the pieces together. Very high functioning, demonstrated a lot of the, quirky behaviors, the awkwardness, walking backwards, bumping into things. I mean, and shyness. It made it through high school, but with flying colors and being able to, take AP courses, et cetera. Made it through Cornell, which is not an easy college to get into or to get out of, and floundering for years, unable to get a job because he didn't have the tools in place, nor the diagnosis in place to help him, go through some of the skill training that autism and Asperger's requires, in addition to just being around other people. I think that the pediatric community at large needs to, further follow through with providing these families with the tools and the skill set that these kids can function better in this world.
Very good. I couldn't agree with you more. Let me respond briefly to say that yeah, especially those of us who came out of our residency program in the 80s have been
And you were stellar.
Oh, you're kind. But who came out of the residency program. In the 80s are on this learning curve. On this learning curve of learning about autism. And so the rewarding thing for me at our center at RIT is now especially, I have to say, it's really great for a community pediatrician then to go work at a university because it's kind of like the next step in our own growth. But our focus really is on parenting, on people in transition, and the dream is to have kids who meet these criteria being able to self-advocate for their life and say, this is who I am, this is how I'm diverse, this is how I fit. And even if they have impaired ability to express themselves, to have the resources to do that. And I think So I would just simply say that your son's probably one of my teachers in that regard.
And Dr. Sugarman, is it also important to say that as we talk about whether or not we should, quote unquote, try to cure autism, there's a difference between trying to, quote, cure it and trying to recognize and value the diversity of someone with autism while also helping them better express themselves?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because there's something that John said that I thought there was a middle ground. Everybody needs help, and people who are really high-functioning but struggling can learn skills for emotional and cognitive and autonomic self-regulation, which is our focus and our center. And we focus on that because we think that actually everybody, whether they have a label or not, could benefit from that. It just so happens that the difference we can make with people with autism is bigger. So across the spectrum from don't cure me, I want to self-advocate, to this young person needs all the help they can get because they can't live independently, everybody benefits.
Okay. John Donovan, what do you think?
I'm saying yes to that. I agree. There is a very big, broad middle ground, and that's where the area of understanding and agreement lives, and the autism community needs to find and spend more time in that middle ground. I absolutely agree.
And I look forward to shaking your hand on Saturday.
Sarah Milko from Autism Up, go ahead.
If I can just add to that, and that's where Autism Up comes in. Now, we're running these social and recreational programs at our center, and this is a place for families to come and get those additional pieces filled in, the pieces they weren't getting during the school day. It's very exciting for us as an organization to be running programs for teenagers and young adults. You know, just last month we ran an adult connections group. We had almost 50 people show up, and anywhere from the ages of, you know, 16 on up to 40, and they're looking for support. And to bring all their families together and to be able to provide that to the community has really been the basis of our organization.
You got a new home?
You know, Evan,
go ahead, John.
This, yep. You know, from the perspective of history, what I hear when I hear our my fellow guests with the points that they just made, the reason that we're even facing these challenges, which are real and complex, is because of what happened 50 years ago when Ruth Sullivan and the others fought. Because 50 years ago, these challenges did not exist because the children were not in our lives. They were segregated in institutions. They were hidden away. There was no responsibility taken by the school systems. Thank God that those parents fought all of that. And in a way, let's say we're blessed with the problems and the challenges that we have now, and these fantastic and inventive and really creative solutions that are being developed are only there because society has decided that we need to do something for the kids and for the adults. And so I say hallelujah and God bless everybody on this call for what they're doing on the show for what they're doing, because we're taking on the job, we're taking on the role, and that's so different from only 50 years ago.
All right, Sarah, briefly, you got a new home?
Sure, we do have a new home. We're so excited. We have about 5,000 square feet out in Webster, where we are running programs for young kids, for teenagers, young adults, you name it. Programs that are after school, Minecraft programs, social skill building, fitness programs, trying to fill in all of those gaps, like I said before, that families just weren't, their kids weren't getting during the school day. We're excited to give that to the community. We encourage families, if you have a child with autism, look at our website, look at our programs that we're offering, sign up. We're kicking off our new programs May 16th. It's not too late. The more the merrier. This is a no-judgment zone where families can come with their kids with autism and get the help they need.
All right, Connie in Rochester, 30 seconds. Go ahead, Connie.
Hi, Evan. I just want to say thank you so much for this show. I have a 30-year-old son who's in a group home now with autism. He doesn't speak. We used facilitated communication with him, but most people wouldn't do it. But he would blow my mind with some of the sentences he would type out. And he inspired songs that I've written and a little book that I wrote. And I just want to say thank you. That none of what you've been saying here was lost on me. We've been through all of it.
Well, Connie, thanks for the phone call. And that solidarity, I think, is something that John Donvan, maybe is that's a good way to set up for some final thoughts here. She's saying she can relate, and I think because of organizations like Autism Up, because of work like yours with this book, telling the stories, building communities, reaching out. You know, you've got the ARC Foundation, you've got Dr. Sugarman's work. These communities, as you say, 40, 50 years ago, it was a different landscape for the autism community, and it sounds like that solidarity is such a helpful foundation.
It's critical, it's crucial, and it's a wonderful thing. And I think, you know, our last caller has a son who's 30 years old. What we want people to remember, Karen and I, is that we've come a long, long way in being much more welcoming to children with autism than we were 50 years ago. We haven't done as good a job on welcoming adults with autism. That's a battle that still needs to be fought. And by that I mean being willing to have adults with autism living in our neighborhoods, working in our workplaces, being our friends. It's still true that, you know, adults with autism can be seen as frightening by some people. That's totally unnecessary. And is not somebody who I would want to be a friend with. Well, that's not true. Karen and I both have friends among autistic adults, and everybody should, and that's the job that needs yet to be done, is to do, in the next 50 years, let's be as inclusive, welcoming, embracing, and accepting of the adults as we finally have begun to be with the kids.
You've got two chances to meet John and Karen, the authors of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, on Saturday. When? At the Riverside Convention Center. When, Sarah Milko?
May 7th, starting at 6:30.
6:30, autismup.org for ticket information. They'll have books to sign there. You can meet them. And then, Tuesday, June 14th, Eric Sheely. What's the details there?
So Pittsburgh Barnes & Nobles at 4 o'clock to 5:30, and then again, the JCC Hearts Theater from 7 to 8:30. Books will be available, people to talk to you, adults, kids, everyone, come join us.
And where do they get more information online?
And go arkmonroe.org or autismup.org.
Thanks for being here, Dr. Sugarman. Great to see you in studio.
Thank you.
Sarah Milko, nice to see you. Congratulations
you.
On your new digs.
Thank you.
And have fun on Saturday. And John Donvan, thank you for the book and
thank
for
you.
Sharing the hour with us today.
It was great. Thank you.
John Donvan, ABC News correspondent, author of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you've had an enjoyable afternoon with us here on Connections. We've got one more day in our spring membership campaign. We'd love to hear from you. WXXI.org/give. Have a great afternoon.